This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hi, all. If you enjoy this podcast, you might also enjoy Alexandria, a Hellenistic world. The Hellenistic period is famous for its epic battles and backstabbing royal families. But for every king or general, there were thousands of other stories. Bureaucrats like Zenon the estate manager, or soldiers like Pyrrhicus, a cavalry officer who terrorized the very village he was tasked to protect. Or just regular people. People you never hear about anywhere else, but you should. Like Tessicles, an old mother wronged by her daughter who moved to the big city, or Eliphion, a prostitute who fell in love with one of her clients. These were real people. These are their stories. Join me as we travel to Alexandria, a Hellenistic world.
A journey across distant realms where mono-appendaged sea creatures reign and the Fae run amok. This is the quest for power.
The quest for power. Grab an oar and sail with us as we look at the myths, legends, and kings of Ireland, Scotland, England, sometimes Germany, and Scandinavia, from the creation to the end of the Dark Ages. I am your unreliable narrator, Michael. Joining me on this journey is my new favorite Chaos Goblin,
Roberto. We're going to see how much power these people held, what made them infamous, whether they were devoted to their gods, if their story is inspiring enough to be a story, and what kind of legacy they leave behind.
And after all that is done, we decide if they are tagged as a legendary monarch, just an NPC, or if they're so horrible that we want to burn them at the stake. You can find us on all podcasts, hosts, or on our website at thequestforpower.com. The king is dead.
Long live the king!
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. This is episode 170, Hellenistic Mesopotamia. Last time, we covered Antiochus III's rise to becoming Antiochus Megas, the Great, in his campaign through Bactria, Indo-Iran, and the Persian Gulf. We discussed the origins of the Greco-Bactrian kingdom, King Sophagasinus of Peripamisidae, and Seleucid expansion into eastern Arabia. At long last, Antiochus not only reunified the empire of Seleucus Nicator, but he even expanded into territory not even Alexander the Great had conquered. As he returned from Arabia to the Syrian Seleucis, Antiochus got word that Ptolemy IV had died, and with him the Seleucid armistice with Egypt. With the land of the Nile in a state of political chaos under the infant king Ptolemy V, Antiochus was poised to begin a fifth Syrian war. However, the story of Antiochus III has also been a grand tour of the Seleucid Empire, with opportunities to discuss the culture and politics of many provinces, vassals, and neighbors. I touched on Seleucid Babylonia a little bit while discussing Molon's revolt, primarily to talk about the process of transitioning the center of culture and power away from Babylon to Seleucia on the Tigris. However, I want to pause our narrative for a moment to discuss Hellenistic Mesopotamia a little more in depth, both because Babylonia remains one of the better documented parts of the ancient world under Seleucid rule, and because I just have a soft spot for the former heartland of the Assyrian Empire in northern Mesopotamia. Diving right in with Babylonia, though, I just want to review what I discussed back in episode 163. Babylon had a very, very long history of chafing under outside imperialism. The city first rose to prominence under the Bronze Age king Hammurabi in a war against the hegemonic powers of his own day, and quickly went on to found the first Babylonian Empire. By the time I started this podcast's narrative, there was a long-established pattern of Babylon clashing with outside overlords, be they southern Mesopotamian rivals, Elamites from Iran, or Assyrians from the north. It was ultimately this tension in Babylon that led King Nabopolassar and Cyaxares of Media to ally and topple Assyria together. Babylon enjoyed a period of self-sovereignty as the Neo-Babylonian Empire, but of course we know it eventually fell to Cyrus the Great in 539 BCE. The Achaemenid Persians painstakingly incorporated Babylon into their own royal infrastructure, and this did largely secure southern Mesopotamia for Persian rule. But every couple of generations, there was still an explosive burst of rebellion. Darius the Great, Xerxes, Darius III, they all saw uprisings in Babylonia during their time. Alexander the Great went even further than the Persians to secure Babylon as Macedonian territory, shifting his capital to the greatest of ancient cities and tearing down the dilapidated remains of the Esagila, Babylon's great temple, to build the famed ziggurat anew from the ground up. But of course, Alexander died. Seleucus Nicator founded Seleucia on the Tigris, and though the early Seleucids did build a new Esagila, it was not the divine palace Alexander had imagined. With Seleucia growing year by year alongside an ever-increasing number of smaller Greco-Macedonian colonies, Babylon began to chafe once again. Over the first century of Seleucid rule, economic pressures drew more and more people out of the city of Babylon, and local resentment sparked numerous minor revolts, violent riots, and civil discontent. However, focusing on the dissatisfaction of the old regional capital only tells part of the story. Babylonia saw a consistent campaign of Greek colonization and Seleucid investment. The growth of Seleucia on the Tigris did draw resources and population away from Babylon, and eventually grew to outsize the older city. But that growth did not come from local influences alone. The arrival of thousands of Greek, Macedonian, and early on Thracian settlers, followed by the inevitable population growth of their descendants multiplying for generations, meant that new infrastructure was needed to feed, house, and clothe the new population. Agriculture expanded with new farms, canals, and animal herds to match the growth of society. Greek colonies and settlement in existing cities likewise required significant investment in agricultural and infrastructure across the region. However, this growth was not all smooth sailing. Greek settlers brought Greek expectations. Soldiers wanted to be paid in coinage. Merchants were used to dealing in prices set by predetermined units of silver, bronze, and occasionally gold. By the late Achaemenid period, currency spending was already growing in Babylonia, but it was by no means the norm. And the sudden influx of silver into the economy alongside Seleucid military veterans quickly led to inflation. The prices of goods skyrocketed in the first few decades of Seleucid rule, which almost certainly contributed to the unrest in Babylon at the same time. Babylonia also lacked the Greek expectations of commonly manufactured goods like pottery, homewares, and certain clothing items, leading to an increase in international trade to furnish the new arrivals with familiar creature comforts, and to sell those to locals that wanted to appeal to the new ruling class. As with the arrival of foreign people, the arrival of foreign goods likewise contributed to the rapid monetization of the Babylonian economy. Of course, this wasn't limited to pure economics. A new, culturally distinct ruling class had arrived, with very different social and cultural expectations for how to govern themselves and live their lives than the native Babylonians. New city governments, either in true colonies or rechristened cities with new Greek governing bodies, were also strange. They followed the political trends of late classical Greece, with a melange of Athenian-style democracy, ruling councils, and city magistrates mixing and melding with the existing systems of local councils and aristocracy. This also influenced the local legal systems, though not to the same degree that the Egyptians discovered under the Ptolemies. By and large, Babylonian law and precedent still reigned supreme in Mesopotamia, but Greek legal principles found their way in, and many people who had to deal with the state would adopt Greek names alongside their traditional Akkadian or Aramaic names when dealing with the government. The influence of Greek culture is probably most obvious in social infrastructure and religion. Over the course of the Hellenistic Age, Greek social institutions were introduced in cities with large numbers of Western settlers. Gymnasia, facilities for Greek athletic events, theaters for plays and performances, and public bathhouses in the Greek style all became the norm. New temples were constructed to honor Greek gods, and existing temples and Mesopotamian deities were identified with Greek counterparts, which saw the installation of Greek-style idols and monuments to hybrid deities comparing similar parts of both cultures' pantheons. The Seleucids continued to patronize the existing temple hierarchies as well, both as a religious duty to the gods they saw as their own under foreign guises, and as a practical measure. The temples of Babylonia were major landowners and socially powerful. Appeasing them helped to appease the population in general. Although they don't seem to have made the annual pilgrimage to Babylon, preferring to delegate it to their subordinates, the Seleucid kings made sure they were represented every spring at Babylon's Akitu festival to reaffirm the relationship between the monarchy and the god-king Marduk. When they were in town for the event, the Seleucid kings made sure to fulfill those duties in person. In fact, when Antiochus the Great was returning from the Persian Gulf in 204 BC, he stopped in Babylon to lead the procession and grasp the hand of Marduk's idol himself. Patronizing the temples was also something of an investment in crisis management. In times of great need, the Seleucids made a habit of plundering their own temple treasuries to fund the army. We saw this recently when Antiochus the Great looted a temple in Ecbatana to prepare for his eastern campaign. If they donated wealth to the temples while at peace, the temples would store and use that investment to increase their own wealth, which could then be plundered later. It was a break glass in case of emergency sort of investment, but an investment all the same. Of the traditional Babylonian deities, the Seleucids most heavily patronized Nabu, the Mesopotamian god of wisdom, literature, and prophecy. This relationship was twofold. Nabu had long been a patron deity of Mesopotamian kings, with the name of Nabu frequently appearing in the names of Babylonian rulers like Nabuchodonosor, Nabopolassar, and Nabonidus. It was an expected element for the monarchy. The Seleucids were also quick to identify him with Apollo, the Greek god of prophecy, wisdom, and poetry, who also happened to be their own family's patron deity before the conquest. The synthesis of Nabu and Apollo made it very easy for the Seleucids to reflect Babylon in their own regular devotions. Now we move north, to Assyria. In most popular, and even academic, accounts of history, Assyrian history effectively ends in 612 BCE. If you are lucky, you might get a reference to the modern Christian community of northern Iraq that is still called Assyrian. But the intervening 2,200 years between the fall of Nineveh and the reintroduction of Assyrian Christians to European records is rarely mentioned. That said, the former heartland of the Assyrian state that lasted in one form or another from the 3rd millennium BCE right up to episode 3 of this podcast retained its name and identity to at least some degree throughout antiquity. For those that need a refresher after 167 episodes of additional information, I have discussed the Neo-Assyrian Empire of the early Iron Age before. They were actually the main focus of episode 1, all the way back in February of 2019. For about 300 years from the 10th century to 612 BCE, the Assyrians of what is now northern Iraq dominated Western Asia with an empire that stretched from the Zagros Mountains to the Mediterranean. Even briefly occupying Egypt and installing the initially subservient 26th dynasty of pharaohs. Throughout their period of dominance, the Assyrians faced constant resistance. Their southern neighbors of Babylon and Elam fought constantly against Assyrian control. The Assyrian conquest of Elam almost certainly paved the way for the early Persians, ancestors of Cyrus the Great, to take control of what eventually became their new homeland. And Assyrian sources provide our earliest evidence for the Medes as well. Eventually, it was the alliance of Medes and Babylonians that did them in, as the Babylonian king Nabopolassar and his Median counterpart Cyaxares rose in massive rebellion turned into a war of conquest during a Neo-Assyrian succession crisis. Famously brutal rulers who bragged in visceral detail about the punishments inflicted on their victims, the Assyrians' former subjects returned the favor in catastrophic fashion. Assyria was not so much conquered as it was destroyed. In both the written record and archaeological evidence, it would almost be an understatement to describe post-imperial Assyria as post-apocalyptic. The Assyrian home city of Asshur had grown to about 300 hectares. The capital at Nineveh was 2.5 times larger. And both were certainly home to tens of thousands. both of Assyria's greatest cities, as well as the former fortress capital of Nimrud and most of their other major metropoles, were annihilated. Nineveh was famously so thoroughly crushed that the citizens of people killed in the Medo-Babylonian sack were still in the streets when archaeologists excavated them 2,400 years later. Even cities that weren't wholly destroyed and burned in the war were abandoned by their populace. A few Assyrian cities like Arbela and later Haran were revived under Neo-Babylonian rule, albeit in a diminished state. But even then, Haran and a city called Dur-Katlimu are the only ones with local records surviving from that time. And Haran only got that treatment because the last Babylonian king, Nabonidus, was born there. After Babylon fell to Cyrus the Great, very little seems to have changed. In formerly grand cities like Nimrud, the ruins of former grandeur was occupied by squatters. The former palaces of Assyrian kings were patched with packed mud floors, and a glass workshop was set up inside a room that used to contain the royal throne. In another palace of the same city, parts of the building were torn down to rebuild smaller dwellings on top of the ruins. Elsewhere, some repairs might have happened in the temples and palaces of Dar-Sharrukin during Achaemenid times, but coinage featuring Alexander the Great in the same layers of soil makes it hard to determine if these were Achaemenid or early Hellenistic projects. During his journey through the region, the Greek mercenary Xenophon documented some of these ruined cities, although the names he used for them don't reflect any other known Mesopotamian or Greek source. The geographic description makes it clear that Nimrud and Nineveh were likely still all but abandoned, save for a small number of squatters in the 4th century BCE. The city Xenophon called Kainai has long been identified as Asher, but he describes it as a relatively prosperous site, which doesn't reflect the archaeological evidence. That said, it's always possible that it was just prosperous by comparison to the desolation of fallow fields and crumbling cities around it. North of Nineveh, Xenophon described numerous prospering villages along the lower Zab and Tigris rivers, pointing to the fact that the region was at least starting to rebound after 2 centuries of rapid decline. However, we should keep in mind that the settlements Xenophon described were only villages, and nothing in the region aside from Arbela stood out at all to the historians of Alexander the Great 70 years later. Even then, archaeologists raise their eyebrows at the apparent prominence of Arbela in the Achaemenid era because it doesn't seem to have been a major population center by any stretch, and may have served more as a landmark village around a prominent temple to the goddess Ishtar than a true city. Even rural areas did not escape the collapse of centralized Assyrian society. Under imperial rule, the countryside had flourished with the construction of elaborate canal networks to expand irrigation and robust pottery and finished goods manufacturing. After 612, maintenance on these canals came to a halt. They silted shut, and the inland villages were abandoned. Only small settlements along the major natural rivers remained, and though there were still some artistic innovations in design, the surviving pottery is also less well crafted. Even this mild rebound in the Achaemenid era might have been artificial. Darius the Great's Behistun inscription references some Iranian Sagartians in this region around Arbela, and Xenophon was under the impression that the former Assyrian heartland was part of Media. Some of the reconstruction in Achaemenid times was likely the result of Iranian settlers sent into the area by the Persian kings as a reward or payment for military service, similar to the much larger settlement of Iranians in Anatolia and Babylon. All in all, Assyria remained desolated for about 300 years between its fall and the Hellenistic period. The region at minimum saw some more political attention under Alexandrian and Seleucid rule than it had in centuries. The area was divided into new administrative units, initially called Mesopotamia, meaning the land between the rivers, by Alexander, while the region around Arbela was split off into a distinct district called Arbelitis shortly after the great conqueror's death. Later Roman accounts suggest that Assyria came back into official use as an alternate name for Arbelitis under Seleucid rule, as they learned more about their new environment. As the Seleucids settled in as the rulers of West Asia, Assyria at long last started receiving some long-forgotten imperial attention. The crumbling and shrinking remains of some old Assyrian cities like Kirkuk along the Euphrates began to grow as important strategic and economic links between the Syrian Seleucids and Babylonia. New canals were dug in southern Assyria, and there is some limited evidence of even Greek attempts to start rebuilding Nineveh. A local Seleucid noble even constructed a new palace at the site now called Tel Bedar. The ancient Assyrian home of Asher became the new hub of a slow but steady Assyrian revival, as the outskirts of the old city were properly resettled by merchants and craftspeople under Seleucid auspices, with similar developments in Nimrud at a smaller scale. That is about where the former imperial heartland stood in the time of Antiochus the Great, still regaining its footing after nearly four centuries of destitution, and although it has never recovered to the level of a great imperial power, the centuries following Antiochus the Great would see the rebound accelerate. But that is a story for another time. For now, we need to move on with the narrative as Antiochus prepared for a fifth Syrian war against Egypt. Until then,
if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
Hi, all. If you enjoy this podcast, you might also enjoy Alexandria, a Hellenistic world. The Hellenistic period is famous for its epic battles and backstabbing royal families. But for every king or general, there were thousands of other stories. Bureaucrats like Zenon the estate manager, or soldiers like Pyrrhicus, a cavalry officer who terrorized the very village he was tasked to protect. Or just regular people. People you never hear about anywhere else, but you should. Like Tessicles, an old mother wronged by her daughter who moved to the big city, or Eliphion, a prostitute who fell in love with one of her clients. These were real people. These are their stories. Join me as we travel to Alexandria, a Hellenistic world.
A journey across distant realms where mono-appended sea creatures reign and the Fae run amok. This is the quest for power.
The quest for power. Grab an oar and sail with us as we look at the myths, legends, and kings of Ireland, Scotland, England, sometimes Germany, and Scandinavia, from the creation to the end of the Dark Ages. I am your unreliable narrator, Michael. Joining me on this journey is my new favorite Chaos Goblin,
Roberto. We're going to see how much power these people held, what made them infamous, whether they were devoted to their gods, if their story is inspiring enough to be a story, and what kind of legacy they leave behind.
And after all that is done, we decide if they are tagged as a legendary monarch, just an NPC, or if they're so horrible that we want to burn them at the stake. You can find us on all podcasts, hosts, or on our website at thequestforpower.com. The king is dead.
Long live the king!